WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. It's a war of words on social media with Elon Musk criticizing the president and his so-called big beautiful budget bill. And CBS's Nancy Cordes reporting.
This fight has now gone galactic with President Trump threatening to yank billions in government contracts from the Elon Musk company SpaceX.
118 charges. That's what Boulder firebombing suspect Mohamed Soleiman is facing. No plea entered during today's first court appearance. He's in this country illegally, and Boulder County DA Michael Dougherty stresses
making sure he remains in the country is a top priority so that he can be fully prosecuted and held fully responsible.
18-year-old student Marcelo Gomes da Silva, who was detained by ICE, is free after posting bond. Agents discovered while looking for his father that the 18-year-old was here illegally. His attorney, Robin Nice.
It's a bit of a whirlwind, and I think he takes so much heart knowing that there's so much support and that people mobilized incredibly quickly.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Aaron Rodgers headed to Pittsburgh. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Aaron Rodgers has decided to join the Pittsburgh Steelers. ESPN reporting the 41-year-old quarterback will report to the team's mandatory minicamp next week. Rodgers was asked if he's kept in contact with head coach Mike Tomlin after he visited the Steelers facilities in person earlier this year.
But yeah, I mean, listen, I've talked to Mike Tomlin. Yeah, great dude. So it was nice to go into the city. I'd never really spent any time in Pittsburgh other than the few times we played there. But I've enjoyed talking to Mike.
So that sets up a showdown when the Packers travel to Pittsburgh on October 26th to play the Steelers on Sunday Night Football. Baseball. The Brewers have the night off after beating the Reds yesterday 9-1. Milwaukee winning that series 2-1. Manager Pat Murphy.
Really proud of our club to respond the way it did. Really, really proud of it.
The Brewers now get ready to host the San Diego Padres tomorrow night with Sports on Mike Clemens.
School sports are played by humans, coached by humans, and officiated by humans. So the next time you're sitting in the stands at a school athletic event, please remember this and maintain your humanity, especially when it comes to judging and critiquing athletes, coaches, and officials. Please show your fellow humans some respect. They'll appreciate your empathy.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Old Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. According to the Federal Reserve's Beige Book, the U.S. economy has slowed to a crawl in May. And you got to look at the Trump administration for this. According to their report, 9 of the 12 Fed districts have reported either contraction in the economy or no change whatsoever. So we are marching in our place and in a lot of places falling backwards. And the places that did see some growth, it was a little bit. And understand, job growth has, it's slowed badly. In fact, in May, private sector job creation up just 37,000, the weakest job creation in over 2 years. We're well into the Trump term now. This is on him. These are his bad policies. This is his chaos. This is all on him. You can't blame Biden for any of this at this point. And understand, according to ADP, the cooling problematic and fell short of their expectations, which was 60,000. Fell short of their expectations and revised last month's to 60,000. So not great. We're not doing great. We saw small increases in the number of jobs in goods and in goods production, manufacturing and mining. Job losses, sectors like leisure and finance, a little bit of growth, not much there. Small and large firms reported job declines. Mid-sized companies are the ones who added a little bit. Wages still remain what they're saying are strong, but I got to wonder. But they're saying 4.5% for people who stayed in their jobs, 7% for people who left and found other jobs. Now, the data is all kind of all over the place. And I think this is part of the problem that I have with a lot of our information, because who knows? Now, Trump has criticized the Fed chair, going to blame it on him, obviously, because he hasn't cut rates. And the Fed's going, hey, we don't know what's going to happen with your tariffs. Too much economic uncertainty. So we'll see. Now, the interesting thing, and I was kind of waiting, I was kind of hoping for this. I was waiting for it. It's one of those things that I, at the very beginning of the Trump-Musk bromance, I was kind of going, wonder what happens when they break up. Will one of the jilted lovers do mean things? Well, it seems Elon has turned. And turned big on the one big beautiful bill. As we talked about yesterday, he said it was a disgusting abomination. And evidently, from what some of the reports are now, is well, he was trying to keep his part of it. While everything else was bad, his part was good. But now he's saying, look, you got to do it all over. Start over. Scrap the whole thing. He says that he wants a bill with no new deficits. And I guess that would either mean smaller tax cuts, which are never going to happen, or deeper, more painful cuts for working people, which I'm kind of thinking if they were to do that is where they would go. Now, you've got the speaker coming out and saying, well, this is, according to him, a beautiful bill. They worked on it for 14 months. It's a great product, he says they delivered. But he also admitted on Fox News that they don't have time to do a brand new bill. And this is where I started from the beginning. I said, you know, all it's going to take is a couple of people to go, no, and nothing gets done. And that's where I want to be, because I do agree with Elon Musk. I do think it's a disgusting abomination on every front, just not for the same reasons. Now, Trump and Speaker Johnson, they're trying to quell the waters a little bit. Evidently, Johnson had a backdoor meeting, a closed door meeting with the House Republican Conference, trying to push back on Musk. But here's the weird thing. This is the weird thing. And this, again, I'm going to tell you something I'm hoping for down the road. The weird thing is all of those Republicans are now got to be worried that their master weapon, Elon's money to primary or go after the Democrats, will now turn focus on them. Because, well, you know, if you remember the tweets, and you know, anyone who votes for it, you know, they know they're doing wrong. The jilted lover could be turning, and it could be fairly interesting to see what he does to them. And then in return, what do Republicans do? Do they go and raise taxes on rich people? No, I'm not predicting that. But, you know, it will be an interesting fight if Trump does push after them and Republicans realize that their secret mega weapon, Elon's money, is a double-edged sword that could come after them. I don't know. Now, Republicans aren't. It's interesting that most of the Republicans aren't really fighting back on the fact that this is a massive deficit bill. What they are doing is they're attacking the messengers. They're going after the economists and the budget experts who have said, hey, this is bad. There's a lot here that's going to balloon our debt. They're trying to discredit the estimates. No, it's not, you know, throw in the number. It's not, you know, $4 trillion or $5 trillion. No, it's they're not throwing anything out that they think it is. But it's about discrediting the messenger. And what's interesting to me is now you're seeing a bunch of economists questioning inflation data now. Because you ask anybody, prices haven't come down. Eggs haven't come down. Gas hasn't come down. I do the grocery shopping. It's actually higher. Every time I turn around, I'm going, how did I not get out of here in under $100? I got a bag and a half. Inflation's still going up, but you've got now economists beginning to question the accuracy of the data coming out. And this is all part of Trump's war on data, war on facts. This goes back to the first term and the whole alternative fact thing. Is what we're being told by this administration alternative realities, what they want it to be, what they're hoping it'll be, not what it actually is? Because again, if you're gutting the funding for those researchers who actually know what research is, and it's not watching YouTube videos while taking a you-know-what on the can, then what? You know, I come back to this. The war on data, whether it's at NIOSH or OSHA or the employment or EEOC or any of those places where they've gutted data collection, what are they filling it with? I'll tell you, it's a steaming pile. And it's either going to be glowing in their favor or they're going to use it to discredit the other side. But either way, heads they win, tails you lose. Not great. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Johnny Jones is going to be here from AFGE to talk about the big win by the TSA workers over the Trump administration. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember back at the end of February, I think February 27th it was, you had Trump's Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, issue a determination memo. And that was directed at terminating the collective bargaining agreement of all the TSA officers at airports across the country, basically ending their collective bargaining rights in their agreement, an agreement that covered some 47,000 frontline Transportation Security Administration employees. Well, immediately what happened is the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, CWA, the Communication Workers, and the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, they filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. And on Monday, there was a determination. In fact, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington granted a preliminary injunction temporarily blocking Kristi and the Department of Homeland Security from dissolving the TSA union. And here to share some thoughts on what it was, why it was, and where we are, I've asked Johnny Jones to come talk with us. Johnny's the Secretary Treasurer of AFGE Council 100. He's also AFGE Local 1040's local president. Johnny, thanks for taking time for us.
I want to say thank you very much, Rick, for having me on the show today. Well, first of all, we can all start back to the history of TSA that was created after the September 11th attacks. ATSA was created to give the administrator the ability to determine if we were going to, the TSOs were going to have the rights to join a union and unionize. And in 2011, after the first 9 years of fighting for rights, the TSA officers were given the provisional rights under President Obama, his administration, and the Administrator Pistol. So we could negotiate our first contract in 2012, and we negotiated 2016, and we also negotiated a contract under the first Trump administration in 2019, and then we negotiated another contract in 2024, wrapped it up and signed off on it in May of 2024 with the Administrator Prokosky, and the Administrator Prokosky was also a presidential appointee by President Trump. And so everything was going well for the TSA officer. We also received the largest pay increase in the history of the federal government back in 2023. Throughout the hard work of the union and all of our allies in Congress, including it was very bipartisan to address these issues. And then Secretary Noem made a new determination, and they announced it on March the 7th, Friday, March the 7th on Fox News to make a news broadcast media. And they wanted to show the power that the administration had to strip collective bargaining rights away from TSA officers and shred a 7-year contract. And when they did that, it destroyed the morale at the workplace. They created management-friendly policies, basically just saying there's no, they actually were saying you cannot allow them to bring up AFGE and at TSA, like there's no such thing as a union. There was never a union. They basically tried to whitewash the book of AFGE and TSA. So then we filed a lawsuit, and we were successful. The judge issued her injunction on Monday, and it was great for the workforce. So the rights are coming back in. Management is slowly implementing these changes. So we're just waiting for all these things to take place and get us back to where we were. It's going to take a little bit of work. The trust in the workforce and what management has done in the past has been, I would have to say, has been taken a swipe, because, man, you know, when somebody does this thing to the workforce, they take your rights away and they try to strip them. You're like, well, what was their true intention? Well, that was their true intention. And now the only reason why we have it is because of we had to file a lawsuit and win an injunction. So,
which is the reason that you have a union to stand up and fight for you and do these kind of things, clearly. But, you know, what are the broader implications of the courts? A preliminary injunction for labor rights within the federal agencies, particularly the national security like TSA. And then, you know, what's the broader message for the labor movement as a whole? Because you are the kind of, you're the canary in the coal mine. If they can get away with it with you, eventually, what does that mean for any worker in this country that has a contract?
Well, let's just put it this way. If you sign a 7-year contract, you expect the contract to be good for 7 years. And the federal government is supposed to be the premier contract holder. So when you sign a contract with the federal government, you might as well have a solid gold bar in front of you, because they are what they call the gold standard of contracts. So if they can take a contract, even though the administration and TSA administrators have had the ability to decide if we were going to negotiate, they negotiated the contract in good faith. They signed off on it. Last year, and then they decided to shred it up. So if you are in the private sector or another government employee and you have a contract and the government is able to, or a corporation for that matter, shred your contract. The danger of this is if they are allowed to do that with TSA officers, you will be next, because as soon as they get a chance, they will shred your contracts next. So everybody should be fighting in the front lines with the TSA officers and making sure not only do we get you to your destination safe, but it's time for the American people and other unions to come to our aid to ensure that the frontline workforce of Homeland Security has the full collective bargaining rights that we fought so hard and have attained, and we had to get them back through legal injunction.
Yeah, you know, you talk about contracts, and not just labor contracts, any contract, because one of the things that Doge Boy and his ferrets, crow about is that they were able to cancel a whole bunch of federal contracts. So it's like the rule of law doesn't really matter to them at all, especially when we're talking about labor rights.
Actually, you're correct, because our uniform vendor has been subject, the people that provide the uniforms to the TSA officers, they have tried to renegotiate their contracts. Anything that has a dollar amount, they are trying to force people to renegotiate contracts, and prices are already set. Make no mistake, if they are allowed to terminate a contract of any kind, whether it be you had an agreement for parking in the terminals, or we had agreements for uniforms, you had agreements for anything that provides anything to the government, and they're allowed to change it without going through an arbitration process or whatever is built into your contract to renegotiate it, that is a dangerous proposition for anybody who signs a contract.
Yeah, no, without question. Can you talk a little bit about how the termination of the collective bargaining agreement had impacted your workforce, impacted the day-to-day operations, the safety of the transportation secretary, security officers, and basically the flying public as a whole? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, when you take away somebody's the ability to have bargaining rights, you create an ability for people to have work-life balance. And once you begin to deteriorate the work-life balance, you'll find that they are like, hey, I'm trying to get these days off, or I'm trying to do a shift trade. And management is not they don't have to follow the procedures that are in place in the contracts. So people say, hey, this is how this works. And now today, well, management, one manager say, yeah, no problem. The other manager like, no, we don't like you. We're just going to do it like this. It causes inconsistency in the ability of that officer to make planning and for them to execute their mission at work, because they're concerned about other things they have no control over, and they're waiting for an arbitrary decision by a manager who may or may not like them. And that's why it's so important to have a contract, because the contract's going to say, hey, this is what you have to do, and this is the process that you follow.
Yeah, and this is stuff that management agreed to. I mean, this is the uniformity that everybody knows what the ground rules are. Everyone knows how things should be operated. It seems, and this is one of those things that's always been curious to me about why employers don't want to have contracts, other than I know they don't want to be tied to their end of it. But the uniformity, the clarity, all of that stuff's right there in black and white. There's no ambiguity. It's right there in black and white.
You know, because when you negotiate the contract, management and the union are fighting. We're pushing this way. They're pushing that way. We're coming up. We agree on these things strategically. Okay, so there's some parts of the contract that we may not like, but we gave in a little bit for on this side so we can get more on this side. And see, basically, when you start sliding the bars left and right, it all works out in the middle.
That's negotiations. Yeah, absolutely.
And so what management would try to do is say, hey, we negotiated in good faith. We agreed to a contract. Well, we just don't like it anymore. It's time to get rid of it. And that's basically what they were arguing in court. And the judge pretty much laughed off and said, you signed a 7-year contract. You're 1 year into it. You can't get rid of it. I bought a house 10 years ago. I've been paying my mortgage. Now, I've never been late. Well, the mortgage company said, well, your house is worth a lot more money. We're going to kick you out. Now you have to go to court to get moved back in. Even though I've made those payments on the house, I've kept up my end of the contract, just like the union kept up their end. Management decided to terminate it at their own free will. And a lot of the managers that had to execute these terms of their employment, because they're like management, they have to follow their rules. They're like, this doesn't make any hill being sense to us, but I'm sorry we had to do this. And that's some of them are sympathetic. Some of them were not.
Yeah. Now, the ruling mentions potential First Amendment violations. What constitutional issues are at play here in DHS's attempt to end your collective bargaining agreement?
Well, when you look at the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly, joining a union and forming a union is the freedom of assembly to so you can put together your own right. When you talk about the Fifth Amendment, also the contract is property of the union and management. And we have rights to that property, and something that we work together and we paid for in our own little way, because the members pay us dues every month. Also, the dues collection was being stopped. It doesn't cost the government any money. Dues allocation has been going on for 70 years, you know, out of payroll deduction. So these are the things that we also... those are part of your rights that are being violated.
And something that was negotiated into the contract. The management got something for that, and they violated the contract, or they violated that agreement by trying to break it. So how does this, how does the union see the decision influencing actions in the going forward by government agencies regarding union representation, collective bargaining rights? Do you think this is going to change the direction of what the Trump administration's attempting to do, and you know what the anti-worker folks are up to, or is this just a bump in the road for them?
Unfortunately, I'm afraid this is a bump in the road. It also depends on. I've seen other lawsuits involving like NTU, for instance, where the upper courts, the appellate courts overturned the lower court's decisions. they may be studying this, like, well, how can we get out of this contract? Like, this isn't like a wartime situation where you need to, you know, suspend like habeas corpus. You're not trying to put people away in internment camps and, you know, stuff of that nature, even though they're trying to act like there's that kind of problem at the southern border. But that's you can't take away the rights of citizens, and suspending your First Amendment right, your right to assembly, your right to join a union, your right to do these things is an attack on your freedoms as Americans. And the danger of this being allowed to continue is that it infringes on not just us, but other agencies, other employees. They're already attacking federal employees in almost every other way. Your benefits are under attack. Your ability to get hired is under attack. They want you to swear loyalty to the president. We got rid of that dinner to President Cleveland administration. That was back in the 1800s when they created the actual law that hires federal employees, because they didn't want them to be partisan employees. They wanted you to be career civil servants. And that's what we need to focus on, is making sure that the employees that are hired in are here to do the job. They swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not an individual or a political party. And that's the danger of some of these things that we're leveling into.
So you're just angry that you'd have to write an essay about your favorite Donald Trump executive order. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And unfortunately, if I wanted to, and also they're trying to say, well, this union didn't play nice with the administration. Well, you didn't even give us a chance to just discuss it. You just terminated it so you could have a Fox News bulletin.
Yeah.
There was no preliminary discussion. It was just straight up, hey,
you're out.
Hit it on this. Basically, that's it. Out of your office Monday, you got to come back in a uniform. And basically, that's how it transpired for the vast majority of the employees. Some people were given, they had to take personal leave as they made these adjustments, but it was just nutty. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the words habeas corpus, which a lot of people don't know what that is. And, well, the director of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, didn't actually know what it is. It's a lot of this is they don't seem to know what is, but they've got an ideology. And I think that's kind of important to point out that this ruling, the judge actually went after how badly they did this. And, you know, what was it? Threadbare logic. Was that the comment that was used?
I can't really, I don't want to quote, I forgot exactly. You know, man, I don't want to quote it, but I'm sure that's what it was. It's just this, the judgment was 43 pages long. The judge obviously took her time in writing this because she knows that this is going to most likely get appealed. But the way that she wrote it is going to be very difficult, in my opinion, to overturn.
Yeah.
Because the contract law in itself is so strong that's what we're really protecting. And we're in a frontline fight for all the other, anybody that works under a contract, whether it's UAW, if it's a CWA, whether it's another union in the federal government, or state local unions, there's a lot of those too, man. They are watching this because there's a lot of local smaller communities that would love to terminate contracts and throw them smaller unions, because there's a lot of other unions in this fight. The flight attendants union, like you said, they may not have the resources. They may not get the backing. So it is very important that we win this, and we win it loud and clear.
Decisively, so certainly. So what's the next legal or strategic step that your coalition of AFG, CWA, and the such are preparing for to ensure that the long-term protection of TSA officers and also, you know, all people with union contracts, that union rights and other agreements like yours are honored across federal agencies?
Well, first of all, you want to make sure that when you're negotiating these contracts, and also you want to understand your rights when you're writing the draft preparation for a lawsuit, is understanding what you negotiated for and understanding the termination clauses in contracts. Make sure that if there's any outs or any, there's a period in our contract, for instance, it's 42 months into it. Management's allowed to take three sections and open up for negotiation. I am assuming that's what they're, at this point, if I was them, I'd be like, hey, what do we want to attack and the ability when we reopen this contract in, what, a couple of years? So those are the things that you really need to be on the lookout for. Those provisions that management's allowed to open up and the union's allowed to open up when you get to those particular moments of time. I'm sure most of those, I forgot what they, I'm having a brain freeze on what they're those provisions are called, but it's basically interim bargaining, mediated bargaining agreements, or when there's changes in workplace conditions that allows those provisions of the contract to be open, interim bargaining, midterm bargaining. You want to make sure your language is extremely strong to protect the union from unilateral decision-making. Say, oh, we open this part up, now we're going to close it, and we're never going to reopen it
again. Yeah, you got to protect the workforce. You got to protect the members very clearly. Johnny Jones, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts. Good on you guys for this win. I'm sure you're going to be holding on to pins and needles as the next step comes. And when that happens, I'd love to have you come back and share some more with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on, Rick. We appreciate it. And thanks for being a supporter of In the Fight and always bringing out the real news to the people.
Appreciate your time. Johnny Jones, Secretary Treasurer of their AFGE Council, 100 local president of AFGE 1040. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this a big deal? This protecting collective bargaining rights for these 47,000 frontline essential heroes? You remember when we used to call them that? Remember that? Ah, yeah, that was so 2020. But I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, Wausau's home for Metnair on Air.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low in the mid-50s. For tomorrow, a high in the low 70s, mostly cloudy, scattered showers and storms. A mix of sun and clouds for the weekend, more storms possible. Highs both days within a few degrees of 70. It's 71 right now.
Matt Nair on Air.
Rick Reed is here, an economics instructor.
Remember the film, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? A driver is riding parallel to him and honking their horn saying, you're going the wrong way. And Candy and Steve Martin go, ha, 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 how do they know where we're headed? Congress and the administration are saying, this is what we're going to do for our budget. But at the end of the day, the Congressional Budget Office basically said that bill is going to create another $3.8 trillion in debt over the next 10 years.
Matt Nair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, you may remember me talking about Iowa Senator Joni Ernst and her, you're all going to die comment. And how my friend Iowa State Representative J.D. Scholten had thrown his name into the ring to take her on in 2026. And hopefully, to be honest, take her out of the U.S. Senate. Send her back with her bread bags back into Iowa doing I don't care what. And I said, look, I was excited. And it turns out I'm not the only one who's excited. It looks like the folks over at the Sabato's Crystal Ball, they have changed their rating of this race from safe Republican. So that is no longer on the map, and that's kind of a big freaking deal. And to be honest, what I love about JD is that this is a true working class hero. When we went on our working class hero tour across Iowa, JD was the guy who showed us around and knows the ground, a true working class hero, working class populist, the kind of guy I would love to see in the halls of power, and we should want. That's why I've asked my good friend JD to come share some thoughts with us. JD, thanks for taking time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with why. I mean, I ask this everybody who decides they're going to throw their name into that fishbowl. Why?
Yeah, at the beginning of the year, this wasn't even on my radar. Then at the inauguration, when you see those four billionaire tech folks in the front row right there, that's when I was like, oh, this is not good for our democracy. And then so I started thinking more and more, the tariffs hit, they're going to be bad for our Iowa economy. And then so that kind of, okay, should I do this? Should I not? I've been wavering. And then Friday at the town hall, when she said those words, they were going viral literally as I was going to a funeral. And I saw that, and the funeral was for a good Democrat, working class Democrat, a long activist family friend. And Senator Harkin, who used to have this seat, was in attendance there. And just being at a funeral, thinking about life, thinking about all this stuff, I started to get the juices flowing. And the next day when she just doubled down on it and gave that sarcastic, very disrespectful to Iowans remarks, that's when I said, game on, let's do it.
And look, you know, you were following your dream. You're a state rep, yeah, but you're a professional baseball player. You know, yeah. To me, I would stick with that. to be honest, no, look, politics is an ugly, rough game. And in the world that we're in right now with everyone wearing their red hat and their blue hat, I think I'd stay on the baseball field.
Well, I'll say it's really hard to play professional baseball, one. It's really hard when you're 45 years old, you're the oldest guy in the league. And it's triply hard when you're running for U.S. Senate. But last night I got in for the first time all year. I was on the inactive list to start the year because our legislative session ran long, waited for a roster move. That happened over the weekend. I got in last night. First guy I faced, I came in relief. Usually last year I started every game, but I was in relief. And first guy, runners on first and second, two outs, and I struck the guy out. So that just felt like the world just came off my shoulders and just had that beautiful moment. But at the same time, right after the game, I had a podcast to do. I, on the way home, I had calls the whole way, and it just that's the weird world I live in right now.
Yeah, life is now going to be about doing interviews and you know, shaking hands and kissing babies and talking about your vision. Because look, we're seeing what the Trump vision is. We're seeing what the Republican we're seeing Republican morality played out as Joni Ernst is about to vote on that big, beautiful disaster. For me, I think this is an opportunity for Democrats to go out and talk about who they are, their values. And I don't think there's anybody better to do that than you, salt of the earth, working class person who knows what it's like to get your hands dirty and your back hurt.
Well, I appreciate that. And right now in Iowa, we have an extractive economy. I mean, agriculture is top dog here. And I mean, you look at most of these small towns, they're shells of what they used to be. And it's a direct reaction to these monopolies coming in, squeezing farmers on both the input side and the market side. We have John Deere shipping jobs overseas. And then in the state legislature, we passed a bill that incentivizes laying off workers and gives a big tax break to companies that do that. Like, what the heck are we doing here? And so my vision for this, we need competition. Whether it's the farm bill, whether it's having multiple manufacturing, bringing that a lot back. It goes far beyond just the tariffs. Like, the tariffs are going to hit Iowa really bad, but we are in an agriculture recession here in Iowa and across the nation, and that is not being addressed enough. And where are our leaders on that? And especially Joni Ernst, who her last campaign election, she didn't even know the price of commodity prices.
Yeah, well, when you get to D.C., you kind of lose track of what home used to look like, I guess. You know, and maybe the bread bags aren't on the shelf anymore. But, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, I look at the talk about tariffs and, you know, the talk of bringing manufacturing back. And it's a lot of talk. I'm not an anti-tariff person. I think if used properly with a strategic plan, they're useful. But not the only club in the bag or the only bat in the box. To me, there are ways to use this. There are ways to do this. And I don't think anybody's really talking about that. I know Democrats, they have to be against the tariffs. Republicans have to be absolutely for them. There's nobody somewhere in that middle ground going, hey, it's a tool, like a hammer in your toolbox. It's not the only thing, but we should be using all tools to make our country better.
That's exactly right. And the way we did it is the reverse of what you want to do. You want to protect your companies with tariffs. You don't necessarily create the industries with the tariffs. And that's right now, especially in agriculture, he's like, well, and I'll agree with President Trump. And you look at our food supply system, 60% of our vegetables, 40% of our fruit are all imported. And the amount of beef that we import is crazy compared to how much like we grow here or produce here. So that is like, so just to bring that back, we don't have the infrastructure for it. Like, do I want to have more American-made blueberries? Absolutely. But we don't have the infrastructure right now. So putting on a tariff means, like, we won't have blueberries for several years. And so it just – the vision is not there.
Well, I mean, as a country, I think we've grown to think everything – there's a silver bullet for everything and that there's a quick fix, a shortcut, you know, a drive-through window, however you want to frame that, that we can be done overnight with the snap of a finger or the flick of a switch, and it can't. And this is where I thought Biden was doing the right thing. I think the CHIPS bill was a huge step in the right direction. I think we were doing some really good things, and I would like to see us pick that up and move forward after this disaster fails.
That's exactly right. And there's so much that we can be doing, and it just what I see from the Republican Party is just punch down politics. It's what Joni Ernst did this weekend. Like, that doesn't benefit us. If anything, I mean, it's going to kick millions of Americans off their health care. It's going to devastate the rural hospital, devastate the rural nursing homes, and then that's going to add stress to the urban hospitals and nursing homes, and it's just the wrong direction we need to be going.
Let's talk about that for a little bit, because, you know, I don't think enough is focused on how bad this bill, this big, beautiful nightmare, is going to be for rural communities, especially when Medicaid cuts happen. How many rural hospitals are going to be closed? How many hospitals across Iowa? And as we're consolidating the healthcare industry anyway, much like everything else, as we're monopolizing virtually every industry, healthcare doesn't seem to be one of those things I want totally in the hands of a United Health Group or some monopolistic corporation.
Right. And the fact that we are the wealthiest nation in the world and we don't have universal healthcare is so mind-blowing to me. And we are spending a lot of money on healthcare, but where's the money going to? You know, it's not going to the care that we need. And so people ask me, like, what are you running on? Well, I'm running on the same things I ran when I ran against Steve King in 2018, and we moved the needle 24 points. It's fight for universal healthcare, fix the economy so it works for everybody, not just the billionaires, and secure our democracy from the billionaires and special interests that dictate it.
And why isn't that message simply it? I mean, Elon Musk right now is the poster child for a 92% top marginal tax rate. Why aren't Democrats jumping on the opportunity to go, look, they've got so much power, they're abusing it in every way possible. It's time we do away with them and we use the resources in a better way to make sure that people get care when they need it, and education when they need it, infrastructure that's going to get things around, people to work, products to market. Why is that not the message?
Great question. I don't know. But that's what we're talking about here in Iowa, or at least I am.
Let me ask you the other side of this. I know there are some other names that have thrown their hat in the ring already. Some have said that You know, some of them are maybe a bit too far to the extreme, caricatures of what the right paints as a left candidate. Where do you find yourself on a lot of these social issues that Democrats get saddled with? That I personally don't. I believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Do what you got to do. We got a lot of work to do. Where do you find yourself?
Yeah, I consider myself a proud Perry populist. You know, I'm kind of an old school Democrat when it comes to that in these parts. You know, you look at the Paul Wellstones, the Tom Harkins, and the Berkeley Bedell. And so those are the things I focus. Berkeley Bedell, for folks who may not know, he was a congressman. He was a Democrat in very northwest, which is very conservative part of Iowa. And he would win by 60%. And his early 80s reelection poster said, the 1% controls your government. Does the 99% have a chance? How do we save our democracy? And those words are as true as ever. And so I tend to focus on that type of stuff. I call out the punch down politics that the other side tends to use, and I just try to amplify our message.
So how do we get J.D. Scholten to be, how do we clone you to run in every district across the country? Because look, I think what you're talking about are true working class values, the things that every family worries about, the kitchen table stuff, all the other stuff we can work through. But it's those working class values that Republicans are now, I mean, oddly enough, are actually starting to move the needle in their direction on, even though their policies are horrible. The fact that the no tax on tips thing and the no tax on overtime is something that Ted Cruz can put his name on and Democrats haven't is, well, a failure of the Democrats, even though those were their idea years ago, it's insane to me.
Well, you look at one of the few people in the Biden administration that had the most crossover popularity, and it was Lena Khan at the FTC. And I mean, she was a trust busting, I consider her our queen, our populist queen. And so, like, if you ask, like, oh, what type of Democrat are you? I consider myself a Lena Khan Democrat.
I have not heard that one before, but I like it. I like the idea that we take on the big special interests, we take on the big corporations, and we restore, well, the prosperity of a working class. So the question I have for you is, how do we get to that point? Because, look, there was just a CNN poll we talked about recently that Americans want their government to do something. I've been saying, you know, a lot of my red hat friends, they like Trump because he's doing something.
He's doing something.
Even if it's the wrong thing. And as I've said, you know, a drowning man will grab an anchor if you throw it to him. How do we give him a life vest?
Well, I think the debate right now in the Democratic Party is, should we go towards the abundance, the book by Ezra Klein, or what's the other version of it? And me as an anti-monopolist, that book does have some like direction on what we should be doing, but the whole side that it avoids is we got to take on the corporations that are holding us back. Corporations have far too much power right now. So we need to add competition in so many industries. And if that means breaking up some of these huge corporations, so be it. But that's going to benefit consumers. It's going to benefit workers. And like for me, like Sioux City is an immigrant meatpacking town, and we've been that way since the 1880s. We need more competition in our meat industry, because right now they're so concentrated. Like 85% of beef is just four companies, and similar with pork and everything else. And so when a farmer produces their protein or their yields, they're limited on the markets they have, and that's squeezing them. And the workers at these places, they're being suppressed. They're working their tails off for a tough wage. They used to be good union jobs, and a lot of them have been broken up now. And so at the end of the day, like, that's how we get this country back and get our democracy back. Judge Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice, has a great quote that says, we can have concentration in the hands of a few, or we can have a democracy, but we cannot have both. I think that is important.
No, absolutely. It's right there. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because look, campaigns take resources, take money, take, you know, boots on the ground. How do folks help?
Yeah, three different ways to help. You can donate. Whatever you can is very appreciated. You can go to ShultonForIowa.com. That's ShultonForIowa.com. You can go there also to volunteer. And then the third way is repost our stuff. That's follow us on social media. You can go to the website and find us all on all our socials there.
I know you're overwhelmed. This campaign coming together on a very short timeline, as you said, you know, look, you're playing baseball, and now you're running for U.S. Senate. If someone asks, what's that one issue that J.D. Scholten dies on? What's that one hill that's your centerpiece?
I mean, I'm, again, antitrust, anti-monopoly is my top dog. But at the end of the day, if we don't do campaign finance reform, we don't get any of the things we want. We don't get universal health care. There's so many lobbyists out in D.C. We have to change the way we do our campaigns because that will free us up so we can have more working class people in Congress.
Yeah, when you say universal health care, do you mean like the VA, or do you mean like a Medicare for all system? Where do you define?
I'm open. Being here in Iowa during the 2020 caucus, everywhere from Medicare for all who wants it to anywhere from Bernie's Medicare for all. Like I don't care. I'm not going to let the perfect be in like. What is it? The quote, the whatever of the good, like it. I want make sure everybody has universal health care, like period.
Want to make sure people get care when they need it. Look, you know, at the end of the day,
it's not hard.
Those are working class values. When you get sick, you get to see a doctor. When you're a kid, you get to get an education. When you need it, you get an education. It seems like
so many of my teammates. And when I was their age, I had to choose between rent and health care in the off season. You know, and my mom doesn't want to hear the answer.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. JD, I wish you the best. I hope you will come back often. I'm a huge fan, and I'm right there. Whatever I can do to help you, buddy.
I appreciate you, man. Have a great day.
You too. JD Scholten, Iowa State Representative, now running for U.S. Senate. I'm excited for him. I think this is going to be a good thing. I think, Iowa, you got a chance. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of JD? Do you think good? Do we need more? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day that Secretary of State George Marshall delivered a speech at Harvard University. In his speech, Marshall made a call for the United States to send assistance to European countries devastated by World War II. He declared, quote, "The truth of the matter is that Europe's requirements for the next 3 or 4 years of foreign food and other essential products, principally from America, are so much greater than her present ability to pay that she must have substantial additional help or face economic, social, and political deterioration of a very grave character." His speech became the basis for the European Recovery Program, or what became known as the Marshall Plan. The goal of the plan was to boost the morale of the Europeans while strengthening trade ties between the U.S. and Europe. There was great fear among leaders in the United States that economic instability would cause European countries to turn towards communism. Through the Marshall Plan, the United States sent aid in the form of grants, loans, and technical assistance. Much of the money went to purchase food and manufactured goods produced in the United States and sent to Europe. This demand helped to keep the American economy booming. In all, more than $13 billion in aid was sent to 16 European countries. Some European labor unions objected to American intervention in Europe as part of the plan. This caused contention between different European labor organizations. As some unions affiliated more closely with the communists, others aligned themselves with the West. The Cold War had taken its toll on labor solidarity. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it appears Karine Jean-Pierre is leaving the Democratic Party. She's done. She's going to become an independent. She's going to think outside the box. My thought is good. Bye. And interestingly enough, you got to kind of wonder. There's a book. There's a book coming out. She's got a book. Are the two kind of linked? You know, because need attention. And this is my problem with attention hounds. It's my problem with party people who are, well, hey, look at me. And I think, look, you don't get to be in her position without, hey, look at me. So, my problem with her is wearing the resume on the sleeve. I'm in this community, and this is my resume. As opposed to, how are we gonna fight to make your life better? You know, what should we be doing? And this is where, you know, I've had a problem with this for a very long time, where I've gone to a lot of progressive, liberal, democratic kind of functions, and it's all, before you talk to somebody, it's all, this is my resume. I'm in this group, and I check this box, and I click this box, and I'm over here, and yeah, I want somebody who's gonna make people's lives better. And oddly enough, Joe Walsh, the Tea Party Republican, has now become a Democrat. Go figure it out. Now, the reason I like J.D. Shulton, J.D.'s a throwback to the days when Democrats stood on economic grounds. How are we going to put a chicken in every pot and a Chevy in every driveway? And how are we going to make sure that your kids get the care that they need, the education they need, and you lead the life that is reasonable? I've often said, look, you know, working people don't want to make a killing. They just want to make a living. And for me, where Democrats, their wheelhouse should be is on the economic justice and living wage part of things. We should be talking about increasing the minimum wage, strengthening unions, strengthening workers' rights, expanding access to full-time employment with benefits. Getting rid of this gig stuff, getting rid of this all of these gimmicks, and demanding you hire somebody, you got to give them health care. Or we move towards affordable health care for all. As JD said, I don't care if it's universal, that the government owns everything, or it's just a Medicare for all, single payer. That's the camp I'm in. But I'm open to any idea that ensures that working people have health security. And then we need to be talking about fair taxation. What grabbed the right and grabbed working people by the you-know-what is the idea that they're paying the tax bill while rich people are, well, not. We should be talking about fair taxation and wealth equity. We should promote a progressive tax code. that shifts the burden from working people, you know, to the people who have all the money, the ultra wealthy and big corporations. We should be closing all those loopholes, making sure billionaires pay their share. Education, job training, these are the things. Increasing the social safety net, strengthening Social Security, strengthening Medicare, strengthening food security programs, unemployment, all of these things that Democrats, was the New Deal Democratic foundation. And then, you know, on the climate front, yeah, but it's got to be a labor-centric one. How are workers going to benefit from it? Look, we can't destroy a bunch of dirty, extractive jobs and then replace them with minimum wage, barely livable wage jobs. No, there's got to be some justice there. There's got to be some reality. Make that a just transition was the phrase that I had heard that I kind of like. And we need to talk about affordable housing and public services and things that make people's lives better. You know, like they did during the FDR years. Like those Democrats in rural counties who brought home the bacon and made sure that the rules of the road were fair for people to compete, and that rural communities had manufacturing bases, and those jobs that were in those factories were good union jobs with health care and retirement security and good wages, so that one income, and I know this is hard to believe, one income could support a family. One 40-hour income could support a family. One 40-hour income could support an entire family. It's hard to believe, and I'm barely old enough to remember that being reality, but it once was, because we had a political system that demanded it. So when you hear about, you know, the abundance theory and making sure that people can buy more cheap junk and fill their lives with meaningless tokens, how about making sure that people have the security of knowing that if they get sick, they're not going to go broke? How about ensuring that knowing that people are going to have job security, that they're going to be able to invest in their kids and their future? How about that? And for me, that's what someone like J.D. Scholten brings. We need more of that. We need to get away from the fringes. You know, I get into, as I said a minute ago, I get into trouble a lot with the fringe. Because I'm not going to check the box and follow along blindly with every extreme. On most issues, I'm on the right side, I think. I generally fall into the I personally don't care. But I do believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Whatever you want to do, you've got the right to do. But as Justice Hugo Black said, you know, you have the right to flail your fists around until they touch the tip of my nose. I don't care what you do. God bless you. Do your thing. Or whoever you believe in. Do your thing. Live your life. Live your best life. But let other people do that as well. Don't always have to agree with what you do. But I respect your ability to do it. But the second, and this is where the left especially gets into trouble. You have to be pure and you have to be 100% in line. That's a problem. And that's how we get away from this middle part of where the economy, the economics, the part that makes everything else possible. That's how we get away from this. And look, the wealth class, the billionaire class, the employer class, they understand divide and conquer. The quote that's attributed to Jay Gould, "I can pay half the working class to murder the other half." We're witnessing that in real time. And the sad reality is the billionaire class really isn't paying anymore. We're doing it to ourselves. So for me, if we can get more people like JD who are talking about, you know, bread and butter, you know, it may not be sexy, may not get the clickbait, but if you can figure out how to get working people to go, yeah, do that. Get me better health care. Get me better retirement security. Get me some decent wages so I can support my kids. I can buy them that, you know, new thing that they want. Help my family. I think you got a shot. But it's going to come back to you and me, us, we the voters. It comes back to us. Throw these clowns and these bums out who are giving us their personal resume, and get people in there who are going to make all of our lives better and do the will of we the people. Because absolutely, without question, I do believe the working class of this country knows exactly what they want. And the mass of us are somewhere in the middle of the road. We want good wages. We want good health care. We want good retirement. We want good education. We want those things. We just haven't been getting it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio. WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump and Elon Musk's public feud kicks up a notch. CBS's Linda Kenyon.
President Trump in the Oval Office said he was very disappointed in Elon Musk, the former head of the Department of Government Efficiency, after Musk condemned the president's so-called Big Beautiful Bill. On social media, Musk posted that the president would have lost the election without him. That's when Trump threatened to terminate Musk's subsidies and contracts, which would affect Tesla and SpaceX. Musk then posted that Trump was in the Epstein files.
The White House says this is an unfortunate episode from Musk. Elon Musk's SpaceX Corporation launches satellites for the Pentagon and NASA astronauts to the International Space Station. Hanging up after a call with China's president regarding tariffs, President Trump tells reporters,
I would say we have a deal and we're going to just make sure that everybody understands what the deal is.
More from CBS's Aaron Navarro.
President Trump said the conversation